The great outdoors is a place of enjoyment, peace, and solitude. But at times, the outdoors experience goes dark. Increasingly, outdoors lovers are encountering criminal elements, psychos, dangerous wildlife, and strange weather occurrences. Our goal is to raise awareness by equipping you with cutting-edge information and to shine light into the dark outdoors.
Welcome to Dark Outdoors. This is Chester Moore, and it's always great to connect with other people doing podcasts on whether it's true crime or wildlife attacks and different things that I cover here on the program. And I'm really honored today to have Kylie Lowe. She is the host of Dark Down East. It has been a number one rated podcast on Apple Music. She's got a lot of really great episodes out there. We're going to focus on a few that really caught my attention. Welcome to the program.
Thank you so much for having me. I love that, you know, we both have the dark describer in our podcast name. So immediate kinship with you.
Yeah, no doubt about it. My whole thing was like the outdoors is usually peace and tranquil, but sometimes it goes dark, you know.
Absolutely.
And unfortunately, but it's definitely a fascinating thing. And also for me, an awareness raising part about staying safe out there, you know. And so for our listeners out there, tell me a little bit more about the genesis of, before we go into the really nitty-gritty stuff, the genesis of Dark Down East.
Well, it happened by accident, really. It all started, I was living in New York City and feeling quite homesick. I'd never planned on moving out of my home state of Maine or being away from New England for any extended period of time. And during that time, I was kind of seeking out any content I could that got rid of that homesickness. So I was watching a lot of Maine Cabin Masters, which is an excellent show based in Maine where they renovate cabins. But also at the time I was listening to podcasts, of course, Crime Junkie being at the top of my list. But I was also looking around for other shows in the true crime genre that were covering cases from my home state. Now that didn't really do much to alleviate my homesickness listening to those stories. But what occurred to me is that the cases from my home state and the greater New England region weren't really getting a lot of coverage. And so I would kind of tell anyone who would listen, someone should start a show based only on New England true crime, and they should only cover New England cases. Someone should start that show. And it took a while for me to look in the mirror and realize I have an education in journalism. I have a background in podcasting and media and radio. I should be the one to start that show. And it wasn't until I moved back to Maine accidentally at the start of the pandemic in 2020, I thought I would be here for a long weekend, maybe a week at the most. And then it ended up, you know, I haven't left. It's been 4 years now. But I, you know, being back in my home state and like being reminded why I love this place and why I'm so passionate about this place and this landscape. And the people here, I realized, you know, now I have the time and space and the inspiration to really make this idea, really bring it to life. And so I launched Dark Down East at the end of 2020 and I haven't looked back.
Yeah, Dark Outdoors came because I kept running into nut jobs, crazy people, criminals and stuff in the wild across America. And I've been doing radio since I was in my 20s. And one night on my radio show, I told this story about getting chased off a mountain by drug runners in Northern California. I mean, that's what the Forest Service told me happened to me. That's who came after you. And I'm like, thank you. You have an elk crossing sign on the mountain, but you don't have drug runner signs. You know, come on. And I asked, is this happened to anyone else or anything similar? And I couldn't take all the calls. It was unbelievable. So it's always interesting to hear other people, how they started, because the passion for it all reflects in the level of research that you do. And you obviously research very well, because I've been able to check out a couple episodes and do great stuff. But one of the ones... when you guys sent a couple over, I originally looked at the Matthew Margolis case. Number one, I love kids. He was a young guy, 13 years old, and he's a fisherman. So can we talk a little bit about that particular case?
Yeah, that was the first episode that we released when Dark Down East relaunched on Audio Chuck, which was really exciting. You know, I'd been an independent creator for the first almost 3 years of the show. And to join Audio Chuck was incredible. And so that was the first story that we released with the new network partnership. And Matthew Margolis, like you said, a young guy, was really passionate about fishing and being in the wilderness. His best friend was his grandfather, who taught him everything he knew about spending time in the outdoors and survival skills. And one of the things I read that just really resonated, really landed heavy for me was, you know, his grandfather taught him how to walk quietly in the woods and just really be in nature and respect and revere nature as well. And he disappeared one day. You know, he was seen around town with his trusty fishing pole, as he always was, and he disappeared. And the search that ensued took people to the outdoors, where he was known to spend a lot of his time along the Byram River. Sadly, his body was discovered several days later, and his case was then investigated as a homicide, and it remains unsolved to this day.
Remaining unsolved. I mean, when they started looking at this, did they have any suspects initially, anyone that was of particular interest?
So really, the case became more public when the case file was released, thanks to the, you know, extensive work of journalists that came before me. Almost 600 pages of case file was released. And that's when the public got an idea of the list of suspects. And there was a hefty list of people that were investigated as being potentially involved with Matthew's death. And they ranged from his peers, you know, people his same age, people he knew and maybe trusted as friends, all the way to, you know, known offenders, offenders with similar crimes against children in their past. Yes.
Yeah, the thing that I immediately thought of was, like, you know, 13-year-old boy, some kind of a sex offender type person, you know, out there. Was there any evidence that that could have been possibly involved?
You know, what's always been said about the case is that there was a sexual element. However, there's never been explicitly stated that there was sexual assault involved. And that, you know, quote unquote sexual element led investigators to look at potential offenders with sexual assault charges in their past. And one of the most recent suspects they investigated, now I'm not going to, you know, I hope people listen to the story to get the full extent, because really, like you said, there's a lot of research that goes into this, and to really understand the case in its entirety, you know, listen to the episode. But one of the most recent suspects that was investigated for Matthew Margolis' death was a man who was a convict, who had convictions for sexual assault in his past. And he was also a former police officer. So, you know, that case, it's still on the books. Greenwich police still have it. And so, you know, that's one that, you know, covering unsolved cases will always be, you know, so important to me, because they need that awareness. It doesn't matter how many decades they've sat on the books. If anything, the longer they've sat on the books, the more awareness they need, because they kind of get lost with time and fade into, you know, obscurity. So definitely go check out that episode to hear the full scope. And I dig into what's in that case file and those suspects. And you can see how there's a number of potential people who seem likely for this crime, and yet it hasn't, there's been no arrest made.
In increasing numbers, people across North America are going missing in the wild. Dark Outdoors is committed to shining light on this topic and raising awareness when public interest in these cases fades away.
This episode's Missing in the Wild highlights the Missing East Texas 8 and Beyond Facebook group. This page was set up to raise awareness to the cases of Chris Sanders, Brad Allen, Leon Felt, Kim Flint, Donnie Combs, Cindy Arnold, Lauren Thompson, Hamil Ross, and James Moore. There are many missing people in East Texas, and while not all of them, or even all of these particular cases, are in the wild, these cases in particular are centered on areas that are heavily forested. And there are a couple of really mysterious cases out there, and unfortunately, there are far more than the 8 original cases that contributed to this particular group of loved ones and concerned citizens. So check out the Missing East Texas 8 and Beyond Facebook group to learn more. If you have any information, make sure and contact law enforcement officials. Check this out. You'll get some great information and maybe help solve cases. Yeah, we have a case here in Orange, Texas, where I live. A little girl named Benaria Finley was taken out of her bedroom. She was 4 years old, and July the 4th, 2001. Remember, the reason I remember the date, thank God, the local television station does a report every 4th of July about her. And she was taken, raped, mutilated, and dumped on an island. And that's an unsolved case. And You know, it seems a lot of times these younger people, that there sort of is a sexual predator element, like someone rapes them and then wants to hush them up and, you know, I did this and I better keep them quiet. And I like to mention that as much as I can on the show. That way people know to look at those sex offender lists out there around your children and family and look at that thing seriously, because there are potential dangers out there. But just otherwise, the fact that, you know, sometimes in the outdoors, like he's out fishing, the outdoors themselves, I'm sure you find this in your case, make solving these things hard because of the elements in terms of like DNA and animals and all kind of things, kind of make these things maybe a little harder to solve.
Well, certainly. And that was a factor in Matthew's case. His mm-hmm. remains were exposed to the elements for a number of days before they were ultimately discovered. And so, mm-hmm. you know, late summer in mm-hmm. New England. And so we have the humidity to deal with, and there had been some heavy rain and then excessive mm-hmm. heat for that time of year. And so a lot of that vulnerable evidence was impacted. So, you know, who's to say what was lost in those mm-hmm. days while they were searching for him?
Sure.
It could have been critical evidence, but, you know, we really don't know what we don't know. And that's, mm-hmm. you know, that's one of the factors you deal with when these cases occur outdoors, or when the outdoors are an element in an investigation.
Absolutely. And I honor you for bringing these cold cases and stuff up, because I mean, like there was a cold case in Ohio brought up on a television report, and a man named Edward Wayne Edwards was arrested for, his daughter turned him in for a Lover's Lane murder. He ended up murdering 5 people that we know of, potentially linked to Zodiac. Is a really interesting thing on that, but getting the word out there, maybe someone still knows something. So make sure and check out that episode. Now, you mentioned your home state of Maine. I've never been there, but I'm all into photographing moose, so I need to come up to Maine.
Oh yeah, we got a couple of those.
Yeah, I've heard there's a couple up there.
A friend
of mine went on the Appalachian Trail there and woke up with a cow moose face stuck in his tent. So
yeah.
Quite the wake up call. Glad it wasn't a bull in the rut. You know, that might have been a little bit different. You know, mm-hmm. but Acadia National Park. I've looked at pictures. A beautiful place. But you have a couple of episodes with Leslie Spellman and Kathy Frost that are kind of tied into that area. Can we talk a little bit about those cases?
Yeah. So Kathy Frost's case, it's interesting that we're talking about this now, because just this morning I was having an email exchange with the detective who heads the Unsolved Homicide Unit at the Maine State Police about Kathy's case. Mm-hmm. I keep coming back to it. Leslie's case. And I keep coming back to it because, again, it's another unsolved case. It's from the 70s. Mm-hmm. It occurred mm-hmm. right outside the boundaries of Acadia mm-hmm. National Park, mm-hmm. but it's long been associated with the park because of how close it was. Mm-hmm. And it's one of those stories where she, at the time, considered to have some risk factors for, you know, being a likely victim for a passing mm-hmm. predator, you might say. Mm-hmm. And, you know, I say that with an abundance of caution, because the coverage at the time was laced with some victim blaming. You know, she was known to hitchhike, mm-hmm. but that was very common at the time, particularly among women of Leslie's age. Mm-hmm. And, you know, she liked to camp alone. And so she was hitchhiking and camping alone in this wilderness area. And she sadly lost her life there. And now the case, homicide was the first in that area for like hundreds of years, which is wild. Like before Maine was even a state was the last time there was a homicide in that specific town.
Wow.
So that for that case to still be on the books, but also there was some DNA analyzed in that case back in 2007 and nothing became of it. Now, a lot has happened with DNA technology, particularly familial DNA analysis since then. So, you know, having covered case after case of crimes now that are being solved with familial DNA analysis, I was kind of dropping a bug in the ear of the detective this morning saying like, hey, maybe you've already thought of it. I'm sure you've already thought of it, but maybe there's an opportunity there to, you know, take a look at this case through the lens of that DNA analysis. And I know it's been years, but hopefully that evidence is still in a locker somewhere. But yes, Leslie Spellman's case is one I continually come back to. Her cousin, Margaret, stays up to date with me because she's one of the last known surviving family members of Leslie. And she's really passionate about, you know, getting answers for her cousin. And then we have the case of Kathy Frost. Kathy Frost Larson was her married name. She too was spending some time in Acadia National Park at Otter Cliffs, and she was with someone who she hoped she could trust, she believed she could trust. And that case was actually solved, and it was her husband of just a couple of weeks, who actually caused her death in the park. And come to find out, he had a pretty storied past when it came to spending time in nature with his wives. So, you know, you think about those areas, national park areas, the more scenic areas in Maine, but particularly like the touristy spots where there's like a transitory, you know, there's a lot of people going through there. The population will swell during the summer months when it's most beautiful. And you think that a lot of the crimes would be caused by a drifter, someone passing through, someone hard to trace down just due to the nature of the place. But, you know, in Kathy Frost's situation, the predator entered the park with her and was alongside her while she was, you know, trying to explore this beautiful place. So there's really that dichotomy of the darkness, and I don't have to tell you, you get it. It's, there's this dichotomy of the darkness that can happen in such these beautiful places. And, you know, when people think of Maine, they think of crashing ocean waves and pine trees and all that. They don't think of this darker side.
Yeah. And that's the thing. It's like, you go out there to get away from all that garbage. You know, you go out there to enjoy yourself. And sometimes these terrible things happen. And it's the seclusion. It's the fact that someone can commit a crime and probably no one's going to see it. You know, it's a quiet place, maybe to dispose of a body, those kind of things. And, you know, getting away from maybe necessarily, you know, like straight up outdoors, another area that I say is the most dangerous place in our country are the suburban parks, you know, green belts, all this stuff around urban and suburban areas where you have trees and some forests, maybe a few hundred acres, but you're not like in Acadia National Park or Rocky Mountain National Park. Just in your research in general, have you found a fair amount of, you know, dangers lurking in that region when it comes to those kind of areas?
Well, I think those areas, we have this assumption of safety, you know, our local parks, you know, I think of the path I love to walk all the time. It's heavily populated, but there are times early in the morning when it's best and the ocean mist is settling over that gorgeous walking path. And, you know, it is secluded and anyone or anything could be lurking. You know, in my research in the cases I cover, there tends to be an element of the places we assume are safe or just, you know, the neighborhood green space or the neighborhood playground. You know, I became a mother about 18 months ago, and I've never been so afraid of a playground.
I get it. You know what I mean? Yeah.
There's my head is now on a swivel. And, you know, maybe that's my anxiety disorder speaking, where, you know, you have this worst case scenario thinking. But truly, you know, these places where we go for, you know, a reprieve from life and to, you know, see my daughter do the slide, which is her favorite thing in the world, is going down a slide. It's like, but what else do I need to be aware of? And it's terrible that we have to think that way. And, you know, certainly I don't like to live in that gloom and doom space, but the awareness, I think, is, you know, first step in prevention. So.
Pray, prepare, and pack heat. It's time for some dark outdoors defense strategies and techniques.
This episode's Dark Outdoors Defense focuses on bear attacks. When people think of bear attacks, they typically think of a grizzly, you know, a grizzly or a brown bear. And when you hear of grizzly attacks, you hear of these, you know, serious situations where bears are ripping into tents and attacking joggers and all kind of stuff. If you're attacked by a grizzly, the rule is to play dead. A lot of times a grizzly is just eliminating a threat. It doesn't like you being in its territory. So if you play dead, there's a good chance you'll survive the attack. However, almost all black bear attacks are predatory. Of course, there's controversy over this, but there are studies showing that upwards of 90% of the fatal black bear attacks that have happened in America have been predatory, wanting to eat the person. And the key is black bears are a whole lot less aggressive than grizzly or brown bears, but the ones that do attack are often out to kill and eat. So if you're attacked by a black bear, fight back. hit it in the face, gouge its eyes, hit it with a stick, a rock, whatever you got to do, fight back. And this is very important because black bears are coming back in my native Texas, all throughout the South, in areas people aren't nearly as used to encountering them as they are in other states. So if it's brown, a grizzly bear, you lay down, you play dead. If it's a black bear, you fight back with everything you've got. Yeah, absolutely. People need to know what's going on out there. And I'm a very positive person, but at the same time, I'm a realist. And, you know, you got to be careful when you're doing these things. And, you know, especially even more so for women. I mean, look at stats on this stuff. You know, my first episode was Stephen Michaud, who interviewed Ted Bundy for 6 months in every day. And I ever did on the show. And I said, you know, he would fool women. You know, of course, everybody knows the story of Bundy, but he took a lot of his women outdoors and killed them out there. And I said, if I'm fly fishing to the backcountry and I'm, you know, me and me from Texas, and I see some dude trying to rape a woman, I'm going to beat the hell out of him with a stick or something. What's good? He goes, would he attack me? He goes, no, he'd run. But if you were a woman, he wouldn't have been able to contain himself. So I'm always like, everybody needs to be cautious. Maybe women even a little more cautious out there. And certainly if you're a mom or a dad out there, always keep an eyeball on your kiddos and who's around them and that stuff. But I want to ask you something about your investigations in general. You're obviously smarter than me when it comes on like familial DNA. So can you explain?
No, I have like a very, it's like a broad knowledge of it. I don't go very deep, but I'm definitely conversational.
Well, I, you know, I'll mention DNA, but I don't go down to specific kinds, you know, because like, you know, but that it seems to be something that is an increasing way they're catching these, you know, solving some cold cases.
Yeah, it is. And I think probably the most publicized one of the last decade was the Golden State Killer. And, you know, I'm not an expert on that case, but that's, you know, really where my ears perked up the first time talking about familial DNA analysis. And so when I'm looking at unsolved cases in New England, it's like, is there evidence on the books? Is there opportunity to look at, you know, a partial profile, a profile that was left on that evidence that, you know, wouldn't have been revealed decades ago because the technology simply didn't exist. And, you know, we're seeing it more often, and the work of Season of Justice, you know, a nonprofit that helps fund that type of expensive testing for agencies where it would typically be out of reach. You know, there was a solve in New England with the help of Season of Justice. Rita Curran's case in Vermont was 5+ decades old, and it was solved and closed with familial DNA analysis because they were able to, you know, trace a profile to a relative to the suspect. And, you know, unfortunately, that suspect will never face justice because he was deceased at the time that the case was closed. But it's this just glimmer of hope and a reminder that it is possible to close these cases that have been on the books forever if people give enough of a damn about them.
Sure.
And if these agencies have the funding, the time, the bandwidth to go back through a case file and see if the evidence exists. And then, yeah, the funding piece is a big part, of course, too. It's a really exciting time, I think, and we're going to see more solves. I'm excited to see more solves in New England and across the country with this technology that wasn't really available or even existed in the last 20 years. So it's really great to see.
So for your Dark Down East podcast, as part of the Audio Chuck family, what is the number one wall you run into doing research? What is the number one thing that you beat your head against the wall and you're trying like you always come against? Is there one particular thing that's a challenge more than others?
Oh, goodness. Records requests.
Uh-huh.
and figuring out different, even just getting through the door of an agency to figure out what they require for a records request, because they can say that they're an open government all day long. But the hoops you have to jump through and the different online forms, and I'm working with an agency in Rhode Island right now, and they're like, nope, you have to send us a written letter with you know, a pen on paper signature spelling out which documents you want, and then we'll send them back to you in 30 to 90 days.
Nice.
And, you know, why can't we just do it on email? Why can't you just digitize it for me? And that's
the
if there's even anything.
Why.
Yeah, that's, you know, if there's even anything available or anything that can be made public. And, you know, I'm also working on another case in Vermont where I know at least 40 pages of case file have been released to other journalists in the past, and yet they're stonewalling me and saying that this case is open, so we can't give you anything. And mm-hmm. Before I get too much of an elevated heart rate about it, that's definitely what I run into most frequently is the records requests and just figuring out who to ask for what and knowing the right questions. Because if you don't ask for the specific document you need, they can say, well, you know, we don't have that information or we can't release that information. But, you know, I think that honestly, there's such a dopamine hit when I finally get through to an agency and they do send me even a page, even if it's redacted, you know, left and right. And there's, you know, four words left on the paper at the end of the day. It's that dopamine hit of like, I did it. I've got it. And now we can move forward. That keeps me coming back. So even though, yeah, I'm hitting my head against the wall, it's worth it. And that's actually a part I enjoy about it.
The hunt a little bit, like you're searching. I mean, yeah, I'm like, I call myself a bloodhound. So like I'm out there sniffing around. Oh, I found something over here. Let's knock at the door and ask. Mm-hmm. On my other podcast, Higher Calling Wildlife, my last episode was about this illegal cloning of an Asian wild sheep called a Marco Polo sheep. I've been tracking this down for a year and a half. I'm not even supposed to be in America. And I messaged the Montana Fish and Game Department, asked them these two specific questions. And I got the answer. I just knew it was a political answer when I got it. But the case just broke last week in Montana. So there is some things released. And when I got the case and looked at it, I went, I know exactly what this political answer means now, you know, you know. And so you ever have a situation where you finally do get something, you realize if you had just broken the code, you could have figured it out.
Yeah, there was a case I was looking into very early on within the first year, that of Janet Brochu. And I remember putting together, and a lot of that case, because it was unsolved at the time, a lot of my reporting on it was, you know, based on secondary source material. So like research based, you know, with journalists who came before me. And I put together that there was this one suspect mentioned one time in one article, who was actually a suspect in a separate case, but the MO was very similar. And, you know, come to find out about a year and a half later, that suspect was arrested for Janet's case. So it's like, I know I was right there and I was asking for the right documents and I know I was onto something. And, you know, I got the answer I got because it was in the works at the time. So that was a neat payoff too.
Well, I have one of a, I'm currently investigating of a guy who they found a body in a barrel on his property. And someone, it's not even anywhere in any news I can find, but I did verify it that this guy and his brother, when he was 17 years old, kidnapped and raped two women in 1978. And he was a junior. They let him go when he was 21. And then he lives across in this national forest where all these missing people are, you know, and I'm trying to get more information, but they're like, ongoing investigation, and you know, it's always that kind of thing. It's a challenge, but I can tell that you're a bloodhound as well, and you like, you know, it's like you're, you know, that's part of the thing, though. I think you can't do this without a passion for getting the truth and maybe helping the world out by maybe this podcast, an episode of Dark Down East, will spark someone's memory or whatever, and raise awareness and that kind of thing. So with that. Do you have a particular episode that you've done that you're the most proud of, maybe?
That's a really good question. You know, they've all truly, and you know, this may sound like a quote unquote political answer, but they've all truly left an imprint on me, and I've learned something about, you know, myself, about humanity in each of them, and even just getting to hear the memories of the family members. In the cases where I get to work with family members, it's just, you know, having lost people close to me myself, I know that memories are so sacred. And like when they send me a special picture, I just, I feel so lucky to play a part in the honoring of their legacy and continuing their story. As far as when I think about episodes I'm most proud of, there's this one case from Maine, the case of Doug Parent. And he, again, another unsolved case that's been on the books for decades. But in my research, I found some audio of an interview that Doug Parent did about 6 years before he was killed with a student at the University of Maine, which is my alma mater. And he was, it was kind of just a personal profile on an interesting, you know, local figure. Doug was very prominent, owned a general store, and he was kind of like the central hub of the small town he was from. And Doug's talking about crime in the area and what it's like in that small town. And he says, nope, as far as I know, there's never been any murders here. And 6 years later, his was the first murder in a very long time. And so I was able to use that audio of Doug's own voice talking about his own life. And that, so that was a really, it was a really unique experience for me. And I just remember being up in my office and it was a dark winter night and I'm listening to Doug's voice and it hit me in a new way that, you know, these are truly real people with real lives and a whole history before them, before the headlines, all they talked about was how they died. So I'm really, I'm very proud of that one. And you know, truly all the cases where I get to speak with family members, there's one that's left an impact on me, Darian Richardson. She was shot in bed one night during a home invasion and actually died about a month and a half later as a result of the gunshot wounds. There was a bullet that was lodged in her hip that led to a blood clot that killed her. But I remember it was one of the first interviews I got to do where I went to Darian's mother's house, Judy's house, and sat across the table from her. And all around her were photos of Darian and artwork that Darian had made when she was a child. And she was still such a real presence in their home. And, you know, people who have heard me do interviews before, I talk about Darian all the time and I get choked up every time because now as a mother, I'm just, I can't imagine sitting across the table from a mother who's lost her daughter in the most heartbreaking of circumstances and then leave and think, okay, now I've got a piece of entertainment to create because that's not what I'm doing. It's not entertainment at the end of the day. It serves such a greater purpose. And so now to, you know, be able to do that on such a bigger platform with the support of AudioCheck, and AudioCheck creates in the same way that I do, knowing that it's not entertainment at the end of the day, that it's, you know, advocacy. So yeah, Doug's case, Darian's case, and all 150 others that I've done. Truly, I'm proud of this work from day one.
And you should be, you know, and that's the same thing here with Dark Outdoors. I mean, I'm not one to, you know, go over the gruesome details of what a, you know, what the National Forest Killer did or one of these people. There's a billion places to do that. And I would have just assumed the martial arts using woman would have sent him to the afterlife, but she almost did in that particular case. We're not about that. We're about raising awareness. And every episode we have a missing in the wild segment where someone's still missing in the wild. We put their information out and it's all about shining light into the dark outdoors. And although you're on a different path, very similar, you're doing the same thing. But one thing I learned on this journey is it changes you a little bit. You learn things. So since you've been on this journey with Dark Down East and other research you've done, what have you learned about crime?
It doesn't discriminate. You know, certainly, like, again, I've said it, you think of Maine, you think of crashing ocean waves, it's vacation land. You know, people come here to vacation for a reprieve. But crime doesn't leave any region untouched. And, you know, while women are a lot of the victims in the stories that we hear told all the time, they get a lot of coverage that, too, there's, you know, some real systemic issues in the reporting of crimes against people of color, against Black men, that, you know, we're not hearing those stories. And so I've learned with crime, while the true crime space, you know, we hear a lot of stories about white women and, you know, certainly there is a risk for a woman out walking in the wilderness to be a victim of a crime, is that it's, you know, anyone can be a victim at any time. It's made me more aware. It's, and certainly, yes, more aware. It's made me more, and, you know, it's given me a deep respect, too, for the journalists who have come before me, who have had to ask the hard questions, who were more embedded in the story when it first broke. And it's also, it's made me ask more critical questions, you know, through my reporting. Yeah. I've learned a lot, and, you know, having to sum it up in one sweet sentence, I don't think I could. And I think I'm still learning with every single story that I cover.
For sure. Yeah. The awareness thing for me too, because like, I've been covering the smiley face killers phenomenon and the Lady Bird Lake deaths in Austin. And those are men. And I'm glad I aged out of that demographic. I'm no longer under 30. You know, and I also don't go drinking at parties on 6th Street in Austin. But one of the things that I've just learned is that anything that causes us to make maybe a lapse in judgment could be fatal. You know, so I'm always telling people, you know, use your wisdom. If you got a gut instinct, go with it, you know, like that kind of thing. You know, even if it's just that weird feeling like I better not go down that street. You know, maybe not need to go down that street, that kind of thing. You know,
oh, men are the worst. Weird, be rude, stay alive. That's what we say at Audio Chuck, and you know, all our crime.
No, be weird, be rude. Well, mine is pray, prepare, and pack heat. I'm from Texas. So that's our dark outdoors thing. So you talked about the crime element. What have you learned about law enforcement?
You know, they're taxed for time and resources. And yeah, they're commonly are some missteps that have been made in past investigations, but without the 30,000 foot view, or without the, you know, decades of awareness or developments in investigations, we didn't quite know that more could have been done or more should have been done. But certainly more than anything, and with the law enforcement that I work with and have a great relationship with, the resounding response when I ask them why there hasn't been developments in a case, and it's because they're taxed for time and resources. That's been the biggest takeaway.
I got you. Now, on the bright side of things, what is one really good thing, one real positive that you know has come out of Dark Down East? Is there anything that you think, you know, there's definitely a silver lining even in some of these crazy cases?
Getting to connect with my audience and seeing the true passion for advocacy from people I've never met, who have never met these people that I'm talking about, you know, it really does mean a lot to me to see people sharing the episodes on their social media. And maybe it feels so inconsequential in your day to just hit the share button and put it up on your Instagram story. But it's been such a pleasure and such an exciting thing to see where people do care, and they are turning around and they're putting their dollars behind some of these cases that, you know, are fundraising for search efforts or a reward. I think that's been the biggest silver lining, is that I now have all of these people who believe in what Dark Down East was created to do, and they're supporting that mission either with their shares on social media or with their dollars. And I think as a true crime consumer, that needs to be the expectation for someone who's listening. Again, it's not a piece of entertainment. You know, it serves a greater purpose. And if a listener is willing and able to advocate for the cases I'm covering, you know, that's the ultimate goal. So yeah, that's been the real silver lining, is just like this community that's risen up around all these cases I'm covering, and people who've never even been to Maine are caring about these people from Maine and greater New England. So that's been really incredible to see.
Awesome. So what's next? I mean, what's coming? I mean, anything you can tease us with in terms of, you know, projects or anything that might be coming up in upcoming episodes, that kind of thing?
I'm working on a case that spans the entire Eastern Seaboard. So it starts in New England, but it continues all the way down to Florida. Wow. And when I tell you, it is winding and twisted. And there's really, even though the case is technically closed, I don't think there's a real resolution here. So I have about 700 pages of case file to go through and handwritten notes to decipher. And this is a case from several decades ago. So why was handwriting so much harder to read, you know, from the 70s and 80s? I don't know why. Maybe someone can tell me. But yeah, it's a case, potentially a two-part story on Dark Down East that I'm really invested in right now.
Well, so tell us how we can connect with you and all with Dark Down East, any social media, that kind of thing.
darkdowneast.com, darkdowneast on Instagram and Facebook, and as well as the Audio Chuck channels. You can see Dark Down East content on there, and also, you know, cute videos of Chuck, our mascot. So don't miss out on that.
All right. Well, Kylie, thanks so much for taking time to come on Dark Outdoors.
Thank you so much for having me. This was so much fun.
If you would like to share your dark outdoor story, email chester@chestermoore.com. If you would like a PDF file of my personal survival tips, put survival in the subject line. Read my wildlife writings and follow my Higher Calling Wildlife podcast at higher calling.net. Remember, never enter the wild without prayer and preparation.